Good evening. Welcome to McNally Robinson Booksellers. Thanks for joining us this evening. We're very proud to have with us tonight David Brown, author of Goodbye 20th Century, a biography of Sonic Youth, and Thurston Moore, author of No Wave, Post-Punk, Underground, New York, 1976 to 1980. So before I introduce them to you, just a couple of little housekeeping things. The first one is if you have a cell phone or some other kind of device that makes noise, now's the moment to turn it off. The next thing is we have lots of copies of both of these books. They're piled up on the cash register, which is all the way to my right next to the door where you came in. So both of these guys will be here signing afterwards. If you hear the author speak, you buy the book, and you get the book signed, that is the complete author event experience. So we highly recommend that experience every night, and you're supporting your local independent bookstore, which is always a good thing. So you're in for a real treat tonight. This is kind of an amazing place to be to talk about No Wave in New York and about Sonic Youth's place in that. You have David Brown, who has written biographies of Jeff and Tim Buckley, and he's been the music critic for Entertainment Weekly and NPR and the New York Times, among others. And you have Thurston Moore, of course, who's one of the co-founders of Sonic Youth, who was right there in the middle of that scene and making it all happen. So you have the historian, you have the musician. David's going to be interviewing Thurston, and then they'll be taking your questions afterwards. And it all happened right around here. So please welcome David Brown and Thurston Moore.
Well, thanks. Thanks, everybody, for coming out. It's a great crowd. About 2 years ago, I was up in Northampton, Massachusetts, interviewing Thurston and Kim Gordon and some of their friends for my book about them. And Thurston just happened to mention that he was also working on his own book, which was a photographic and oral history of the No Wave scene with his friend Byron Coley. Those of you who don't know what No Wave is, do you want to just quickly describe...
No Wave. No Wave was sort of a term that was given a little belatedly to a sort of a sub-scene of downtown sort of art punk rock in 75 to around 79 when it sort of imploded. And it was defined by certain individuals and bands and photographers and filmmakers. Names like Lydia Lunch, Teenage Jesus and the Jerks, and James Chance and the Contortions, bands like Mars. And it was sort of somewhat geographically sort of delineated by bands from the East Village and bands in Soho, which is sort of like kind of the art district of downtown New York at that point and at that time. And how that relationship between those two sort of different geographical factions and the individuals who sort of straddled both scenes and the different sort of aesthetics that were at work at that point. As the book sort of deals with it in the No Wave book we did, there's a couple of books out on the subject. Ours sort of deals with it in a really strict way where we really draw really hard parameters about who were the real architects of this music and this art form. And so we... both Byron Coley and I were sort of around at that time, and we were somewhat friendly with some of the participants. And we were really able to draw a sort of a real genuine tree of who you could designate as No Wave, because it's kind of a term that's taken on much broader aspects since its time, because there's so much reference to it. And of course, there's bands such as ourselves and bands like Swans and Live Skull and Radar and these bands that were existing in New York in the early to mid 80s and onwards who were always considered to be coming out of the No Wave scene. And most histories of No Wave will always bring that into the story about of all this other stuff that serves more referential. We didn't want to deal with any reference, we wanted to deal with the people who are really actual. Because it was very non-rock and roll. And in fact, when any of these musicians or artists played any semblance of rock and roll, it was over. We weren't interested. It was not No Wave anymore. So when Teenage Jesus and the Jerks, Lydia Lunch, started playing in a band called Eight-Eyed Spy, it sort
you,
of...
You and Kim went to one of those shows together.
Kim and I kind of like sort of met around that
dates,
time
as it were.
Of seeing Eight-Eyed Spy at Tier 3. And Eight-Eyed Spy sort of was... an unbelievable situation because it was Lydia Lunch coming out of this very atonal scream of a band called Teenage Jesus and the Jerks and the word was out that she was like in a kind of a boogie rock band. And so everybody had to go see what this was all about. And it was great. But it was kind of using traditional aspects of rock and roll, and therefore we kind of just sort of closed the door right there. And anything like that, such as the Bush Tetras, you know, coming out of the Contortions, et cetera, we just we basically, that's where we end it. So it sort of ends in 81, by the point where all these people sort of develop into actual musicians.
Before I get to that, I always wonder how could you tell when a new wave band sucked? If the point was, like,
that's a good question. Well, I think that the general consensus that everything else sucked. You know, okay. I don't think that was really nobody really cared, and nobody had any ambitions about, like, you know, sucking or not sucking at that point anyway. It was a very, you know, there was no real media eye on this scene. Nobody really knew about it above 14th Street, you know. Right. I mean, it's like the fact that it's sort of something that people sort of talk about referentially in rock history is kind of really amazing, because nobody would have thought about that at the time, because it was really of its neighborhood, you know. It was like pretty much this neighborhood to some degree, which is hard to believe.
And the neighborhood a neighborhood, just to put some context, I mean, one of the areas where both of our books overlap is talking about New York City roughly 30 years ago, late 70s, early 80s, which is actually when Thurston and I both came here. You came around 77 from Bethel, Connecticut.
Yeah.
I came here the following year from New Jersey, started NYU. And it really was an amazing period back then, because you had this incredible community south of 14th Street of musicians, artists, conceptual artists, painters, all kind of working in different camps, but also putting forth this whole postmodern sensibility of, like, stripping everything down, like Thurston said, of no wave. Nothing existed before. You were kind of starting from scratch, in a way, it seemed. That,
well, those bands also existed concurrently with the first generation of New York punk rock. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, a few of the people who figure in the book were a little upset that we were using the word post-punk in the title, because it's like no wave, post-punk. And it is a little misleading, because a lot of the bands were started in 75, 76, the same time as bands like Television and Patti Smith Group were forming their sound. So it's only, you know, our response is that, well, it's only post-punk, the fact that it really... The bands really wouldn't exist without the actuality of punk rock existing. So, in a sense, what they were doing was kind of beyond something that was already marginalized in music culture.
Yeah, Lydia Lunch thought Patti Smith was, what, classic rock or
yeah, yeah, I mean, I was a huge Patti Smith fan. One of the reasons I came to New York as a teenager is because I sort of wanted to sort of be closer to her scene. And in 77, I mean, she was kind of like the top of the heap as far as, like, what was going on here. And all of a sudden, these people my age from different places were here as well. And there's all kinds of different sort of cliques and of people moving in here. But she kind of... People like Lydia and James Chance were really putting across this case where it's like, they were already denouncing the bands that we kind of held sacred, the bands that already kind of, like, separated themselves from the hippie rock scene. And so all of a sudden you had Lydia Lunch at 18 years old coming to New York in 1976 saying that she was the anti-Patti Smith and that she was going to destroy her no matter what it took. And that Patti Smith was basically a holdover.
How did Patti respond to that?
Patti was totally unaware. I mean, the only people who were aware of it were people who would read Soho Weekly News, you know, where these interviews would take place, that people like Roy Traken would do, these journalists. And they were fascinating because the interviews were just astonishing. You know, the way they looked was astonishing because they were just like, they were really cutting themselves very hard as far as, like, it wasn't classic London punk rock and it wasn't like Johnny Thunders looking either, but it was something else entirely. And it was very sort of noir, black and white kind of, and very severe. And they were coming out and saying, like, we don't have time for wanky guitar solos a la television or hippie poetry a la Patti Smith. And mm-hmm. so that was really, to me, I was like, well, this is happening too fast. We've already got rid of the Rolling Stones and the Beatles with Patti right. Smith and television. Now these guys are coming in, like, you know, so mm-hmm. soon after the fact and trying to destroy our heroes. So it was very confusing at the right. time.
And what's, I mean, you're someone who grew up listening to a lot of, you know, Alice Cooper and David Bowie up through, like, the Stooges and Patti Smith, people who did those things called songs. And but yet you were attracted to No Wave. What about
I wasn't
that
attracted
stuff?
To No Wave at the time. At the time, I was really put off by it. I thought mm-hmm. these people were really kind of offensive. And I mm-hmm. was like, you know, Patti Smith's great. Television's great. And I wouldn't go see them play because, well, first of all, I didn't have any money to go see them play. And if I had money, I would go see the Ramones somewhere for, like, you know, $4 or $5. And these mm-hmm. bands would play. I wasn't going to spend the $3 to go see a band of people who lived in my neighborhood who were, you know, saying such things. It wasn't like they befriended me. They were hard mm-hmm. to get near. I mean, they sort of, like, kind of hung out together, and they really cut this really sort of weirdly kind of damaged, sexualized kind of figure in a way. Mm-hmm. I was just like a bohunk kid from Connecticut. I didn't know what to think of it. I mean, I was intrigued, but I couldn't really sort of decode what was going on. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't really until I heard one of the recordings and Lydia did a record really early in 77 with her first single with Teenage Jesus and the Jerks, and there was a review of it in Hit Parader magazine. And there was this guy, Ed Naha, who was a rock journalist, and he would review singles in Hit Parader, and he would have little icons next to the singles. And basically it was kind of a heart thumping, I think, was sort of like mm-hmm. a great single. But if it was a shitty single, it would be like a boot kicking. And next to the Teenage Jesus single was four boots in a row, which I had never, you know, seen before. And I was a voracious kind of, you know, rock magazine reader, and I was really sort of taken aback by this. And the review sort of said, this is the worst sounding record ever made. It sounds like a cat being murdered. And I was like, I have to hear
you
this.
You have to hear that, absolutely.
And I went down to Free Being.
It's like when Folkways Records put out that album of all frogs. Just yeah. frog recordings.
Yeah,
like,
I was still looking for that record, yeah. I went down to Free Being Records on 2nd Avenue and St. Mark's near Gemspa, and it was cool because they actually had, if you bought the single, you would get the promotional poster of the single. And the promotional poster of the single is what really sort of led me into wanting to know more about this group of people, and because it was this photograph that Julia Gorton took of Lydia that was really sort of fetching, but it was very cut and paste, and it had this kind of leopard, black and white leopard skin backdrop, and kind of ransom note letters, but not like Sex Pistols style, more something else going on. It was this whole other New York vibe, and that's sort of what that kind of design aesthetic was what really made me want to sort of find out more about these bands, because they had a sense of design, and a lot of it was sort of put across by the photographers who were taking photos of these bands. Certainly somebody like Julia and, you know, Stephanie was taking a lot of photos, and Godless was taking a lot of photos. And I think the idea of taking photos of punk rock bands in New York was like kind of a big deal at the time, because you were here and you could do it, and you were sort of in, you know, you were at the nexus for that stuff. Mm-hmm. And what was really interesting is that there was a lot more going on subterranean to that scene, such as these bands, the No Wave bands. And I think a lot of these photographers were out every night and they were shooting everybody. So they actually had these documents of these bands that nobody right. really cared about at the time, but they held on to them, right? I mean, yeah. Stephanie held on to them. And so when we went knocking on these photographers' doors, we were just like, you know, we don't want to see any Talking Heads photos. We don't want to see any Elvis Costello photos. We want to see Mars. And these guys had them, you know.
We never expected them to see the light.
And you never expected anybody wanting to see this stuff. Yeah.
Since you mentioned shows were $3, that is one of the fascinating things, of course, when you look back at 30 years ago, shows were that cheap. You know, this was a period of time when late 1980, the median salary of in Manhattan of someone was $14,700.
Well, $3 was, I remember when they went from $2 to $3 at CBGB, people were pissed. But some people wouldn't go. You wouldn't go. He's like, forget about it. You'd turn around. It's like, I'm going to pay $3.
Wow. It's amazing.
It was like $2 for a while, and then it early 77, it was $3, and it was like, you thought Hilly was really just kind of like really, really greedy.
And the average rent of an apartment in this area was $175 a month, and you could rent a gallery space for about $500 a month, and there were like almost 40 of them around here. It was a pretty different time. How did you survive back then?
How did I survive? I would get sort of odd jobs and stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's in the No Wave book. Lydia sort of has these great sort of accounts about how she would survive, and she would, you know, she would do devious things, such as get she would get money for her heart foundation, like in a little box, and she'd go stand in the corner. She says, if you get $10 in one day, that can get you through the next 3 days. And that's, you know, it was fine. Or she could talk somebody into like letting her stay in a vacant building down in Tribeca because there's, you know, she can keep an eye on it for them or something like that. Right. You could do, I mean, it's just the way it was, you know. But when you're 18, you come to the city, you don't really think about survival. You just, I don't know, it's not, it's...
When I was interviewing Glenn Branca for this book, he moved to the city. Glenn is a composer, minimalist composer, downtown kind of guitar symphony guy who influenced people like Sonic Youth. He moved here in 76 from Boston, and he told me his friends up in Boston were saying to him, like, are you insane? Why are you moving to New York? It's like this awful, degraded place and the crime rate and everything. Did you hear anything like that from friends or family when you made the move?
Yeah, my mom thought I was going to be lost in sort of like some weird land of drug addiction and crime. And I basically had to say it's cool, you know. And I got a job at one of the first jobs I got was at this mastering studio called Master Disc.
Is that Glenn Branca?
I got the job from the one ads in the back of the New York Post of all places, and it just sort of said wanted shipping clerk, and it happened to be this kind of job, this music job, and it was really strange. But
then you got silly rock stars come through, didn't you? Like mixing their records, mastering their records.
Yes.
Like.
Yeah. I don't know, like Brian Ferry. Bonnie Raitt. Yeah, it was kind of funny, but I got fired because I didn't have a telephone. I couldn't really afford to have a telephone, so I would. I mean, this is not really that interesting. I don't think. But, you know, I mean, people always sort of, I always have a little conflict about talking about New York nostalgia because it's like anytime anybody sort of decides to move to New York, no matter what that period is, I mean, that's their identity right there. I mean, you create your identity for, like, what the situation is. And it's I never really sort of bemoan the changing of New York City in any way, because it's a city that's always been about being in flux in a way. Because when I remember, 76, 77, it was totally crazy around here. I mean, it was kind of a Wild West kind of scene. Everything was dilapidated and falling apart. There was no money in the city at all. Government had turned its back on it hardcore. I mean, it was just like, we are not funding the city at all. And it was there was a decade of just complete rot and disrepair. And as Lydia says in the book, I mean, it's like at that time period, at that age coming to the city, it felt like the apocalypse had already happened and you had reached the end of the world. And that was like the playground that we were in. And so it really did have a sort of a psychological effect on like how you were making music and making art at the time. And so that kind of radical action in the music was really, it did have an environmental kind of factor to it for sure.
Right.
But, you know, to sort of say that those were the glory days, or, I mean, I don't think that's kind of fair to anybody, you know. I mean, I'm not getting after you.
I don't take it personally.
I mean, I can still walk around New York and still go down, like, you know, if you walk down 2nd Street between even like the Bowery and what's east?
2nd Avenue.
I mean, it's still, I mean, you can still flash on. It's still there. I mean, that's, to me, I mean, that's almost like the 60s there in a way. I mean, it's still kind of has that vibe, right. You know. Has it been really crushed upon? What?
You haven't walked on it recently enough.
I was there about 45 minutes ago.
Oh, okay.
That's why I mentioned that one street.
You noticed the Avalon. I think that's the name of it.
No, I didn't notice that, actually.
Well, speaking of the glory days, we're like kind of in a sonic historical landmark building central. There are all these places right around here people don't, in case they know about. If you were to go down Lafayette to Broome Street and make a left, there was a place called A's.
A's was a performance space on Broome Street between the Bowery and Christie,
yep.
And that was a fantastic place that's really not sort of talked about at all in any sort of New York rock history books as of yet. There's somebody I know who's actually trying to put together a film documentary, and it was called A's because it was a performance artist who still lives there, actually, named Arlene Schloss. And that was kind of this place that was even more kind of off the beaten track than the clubs that people remember from downtown, such as the Mud Club and Tier 3.
That was a place where if you couldn't afford the Mud Club, you went there.
Yeah,
and
bands,
in a way, it
didn't really advertise beyond the neighborhood. It was just sort of flyers, but... like when Sonic Youth first started, we had different names before we were called Sonic Youth. We called ourselves Red Milk and
Male Bonding.
Male Bonding.
Well, the very first show you ever did with Kim, December of 1980, was at A's. You were Red Milk.
Yes.
And that was
it was
like
disastrous.
A disastrous.
Yeah. It was hard.
What are your memories?
Well, we didn't know. I mean, I think we were. We couldn't hear each other, and this drummer that we had with us played really loud, so we just sort of looked at each other and didn't have any idea where we were, but the drummer seemed to know exactly where he was, and he just pummeled through every song. Going through all the changes while we just kind of like stared at each other and were caught in this whirlwind of complete hell. And so, yeah, that was horrible. That was our first show. We were called Male Bonding.
Mm-hmm.
And, but A's was this great place because it was bands would play bands like Liquid Idiot, who became Liquid mm-hmm. Liquid, and ESG would play there really early on. And
the Coachmen, your first band?
The first band I was in, the Coachmen, and Alan Vega from Suicide was always doing sort of solo stuff there. And a lot of it was documented to some degree, but the documents are just so, I don't know, it's really sort of messed up archives that I think Arlene has that people are trying to
put together.
Yeah,
I've seen them, those boxes of things.
But that was really sort of a downtown New York sort of art and music hangout. And that's, I remember seeing remarkable things there in retrospect. I remember seeing Samo, which was like Jean-Michel Basquiat's trio of, which was great because you sort of knew that name because you would sort of see it on the walls, and then all of a sudden there was a band called that, and it was these guys. They were Samo. It was this guy Al Diaz and Jean-Michel and Shannon, and they were Samo in a way. Jean-Michel sort of took off with it, but the three of them, it was a kind of a group thing. And they were great, and it was just sort of conga drums, trumpet, and Jean-Michel was playing like just cracked electronics that he had built, and it was total sort of weird rhythmic noise music mm-hmm. at the time, and it was really good.
And then if you went down to Spring and all the way west, there was White Columns, which is an art gallery, where you guys also did one of your very early shows, where Kim had some art installations there as well.
Yeah.
And there was a thing called the Noise Festival in 1981, which was for all these new bands like Sonic Youth and so forth.
White Columns was it's still a gallery in the West Village, and it's a fairly renowned gallery. But at that time, it existed on Spring Street across from Ear Inn, which was sort of a poet's hangout, and way west on Spring Street, almost to the West Side Highway. And this fellow, Josh Bear, who ran it, and his mother was Jo Bear, who was sort of a noted conceptual artist from the 60s. She was the one who would do the pure white canvases throughout the 60s. And Kim had, you know, Kim was had come to New York to be a visual artist. I mean, she drove out cross country from Los Angeles with the artist Mike Kelly at the time together. And Mike Kelly was really kind of wondering why you didn't interview him for the book.
I tried. You know,
oh, you did?
I called him, and then like he never...
He's like, oh, man, I got so many stories I could tell that guy.
Well, you know, when I first called him, he's like, I don't think I could remember anything. And I said, well, think about it, and I'll call you back. And I called him back, and he never...
Typical artist.
Yeah, I know.
So they drove out together, and so Kim sort of was definitely involved with the art world. And when I met her, she was working at Anina Nosei's gallery in Soho, and which became the gallery that kind of first showed Jean-Michel's work outside of the street. And
one of her exhibits at her installations at White Columns was chairs from your friends, right?
Yeah, one of the first shows that Kim had curated at White Columns was she had asked different artists downtown to exhibit a chair from their living environment. And so you would walk into the space and there would be all these chairs. And it was great because at the opening, I remember just going there and there was all these, it was a whole art scene, walking around, looking at the chairs and hanging out and being cool. And then and I sat down on one of the chairs. And I was like, well, they're chairs. And I could tell like the vibe in the room was like, you're sitting on the artwork, you know. And I had just met Kim, and she sort of came over, and I was just like, you know, I was like 18 years old, and you know, I didn't really care. And so I was just, and she's like, you know, that's exactly what you're supposed to do. And so we kind of, and the rest is history.
You knew. She knew you were the one.
Yeah, that's kind of.
And then further up here on Lafayette was the aforementioned Josh Bear's apartment, which he also was the guy who, with Glenn Branca, started Neutral Records, which was the little indie New York label. There weren't too many New York indie labels at the time.
The only label that
released Sonic Youth's record. And you actually worked out of his apartment, right, on Lafayette, like trying to sell the record?
The only record label that was releasing music from bands downtown at the time, really, was this label called 99 Records, and it was on 99 McDougal Street. And it was a great store run by this guy, Ed Ballman. And his wife sort of sold punk rock fashion in the back. And he was importing all these really great records from England and selling them. Records that were really focused as far as like being kind of progressive from what people knew about punk rock at that time. And you usually would go to Bleecker Bob's and buy these records, but it was like Bleecker Bob's was just sort of like a meat market of this stuff. And you had to sort of make your own sort of judgment on what was good. This guy was kind of bringing in really interesting music that was really more in tune with bands like Public Image Limited and the Slits and the Raincoats, and that was really informative for us. And that became like the real hangout for our bands when we first started. Mm-hmm. This is like when the no wave scene kind of dissipated, and he put out the first Bush Tetras 7-inch and first Glenn Branca 12-inch. And when we first started,
but he didn't want to sign you guys.
Yeah, for some reason, it was like, we were going to be the next band. And he put out the Liquid 12-inch, which became big news because it's the record that Grandmaster Flash had sort of sampled White Lines from, and it really sort of put 9-9 on the map. But he wouldn't put our record out. I don't know. He didn't really think. He thought maybe we were I don't know. We were sort of kind of separating ourselves from just that staunch downtown thing. I mean, we always sort of had this ambition to sort of just get in a car or get in a van and just sort of head out of town and play outside of New York. And that was something that we realized that we wanted to do immediately, is like not sort of get too stuck in one place. So And Lee had already been doing that in a way, because he was playing with Glenn Branca, and Branca sort of had the same idea. I mean, he immediately would tour, and bands didn't really tour. There was no real network at that time for touring. There was like maybe one booking agent in New York who would deal with certain bands on a level like that. But people, you didn't really leave and go on tour the way people tour right now. There was nowhere to go. I mean, you know, and
Sonic Youth were so had such much foresight or something that 6 months after your first record came out in 82, you guys went on a tour of the South.
Yeah,
which is, sounds
well. For some reason, Lee had a bunch of names that he had gotten from somebody, these little clubs, and we just called them up and said, "We're this band from New York, and we'd like to come and play." And they're like, "Well, you can come down and play. It's on a Monday night," and everybody said, "You can have the Monday night." So the tour was basically us playing on a Monday and then sort of not doing anything until the next Monday, because that was the only time they would let us play. And then we would come down, and there'd be no promotion, and there'd be nobody there. I mean, we would. 9 times out of 10, there would be nobody there except for whoever happened to be there having a drink at the time. Right. And it would be us.
There was one guy yelling Freebird the whole time.
Always. Yeah. And it was crazy. And it was us and this band called Swans, who at the time were at their most just pummeling. I mean, they were just like this ferocious kind of noisy beast of a band. Really negative. Yeah. But, you know,
they made you guys seem like Donovan or something.
Yeah, compared to them, we were. But you know, it was an adventure. That's all we really wanted anyway. So we didn't really have we had no idea of what we were getting into.
What do you think is there a legacy of No Wave? And if people were to listen to those records now,
I think there's certainly it's interesting because No Wave the first references of No Wave were certainly bands like us and Swans and a band like Live Skull and Rat Out Runner. And there were some bands from different parts of America, and there's some bands also from Europe who are aware of it. When I first met the band The Boredoms from Japan, they were all about No New York and No Wave bands. And that's what they wanted to know about, and that's what they were really into. When I remember first hearing about Einstürzen und Neubauten, the band from Berlin, who were really radical, and they would come out with cement grinders on stage, and they were like all about No Wave. That's all they wanted to know about. So it was really sort of surprising to us at the time. It was like, well, you know, nobody went to see those bands. I mean, it wasn't like those bands were that popular. The Contortions got kind of hot for a while because of a lot of the antics that were going on. Plus, the music was really sort of... The Contortions were decidedly... they got pretty, like, hardcore funky at a point. When they first started, it was just like a blare. But James really wanted this kind of damaged, badass James Brown funk band, you know. But, you know, James Chance was not James Brown, but he put on this persona of wanting to be James Brown. But he was like the skinny little redhead kid from the Midwest who came to New York to reinvent himself as James Brown, you know, and it was like it was completely insane, you know, but it kind of worked. I mean, it was a little hard to deny his thing. So they became really popular because they actually became very very musical and just a lot of fun .
Well, I think we have to stop at some point and take questions before 8 o'clock. So, fire away if anybody.
Did you, when you're putting together the book, did you ever consider maybe putting like a discography of some of the records released?
Oh, putting a discography, a No Wave discography. We did, and I think we decided not to because I think what we want to do is sort of make an adjunct publication that sort of deals more with the recordings and the ephemera of No Wave. We tried to keep the book, you know, editorially, like, not, we really wanted it to sort of be sort of dictated by the photography and just the really lean history that we had. And Mark Masters had did a book called No Wave that came out of a UK publisher. I think Black Cat did it. And he really dealt with the recordings as far as like how he documented the history of the music. And he would talk about the different recordings. And the Mark Masters book came out a few months before ours, and we were able to sort of see it in galley form, and we saw the nature of how he presented that book. And so we sort of stepped back from that. We decided not to do that anyway. But discographies, you know, they're readily available online these days, so we didn't really feel... We made that family tree that goes in the front of the book, which was... Which was, you know, when we first saw that, it was just like, this is the most perverse thing ever. It's like these, you know, these bands, how they lead into each other. But it just looked ridiculous because it's like, who knows these bands? I mean, most of them were just like undocumented. It was so internal that I really liked it as a, you know, it's almost like this kind of just fetishized kind of take on the scene in a way, which is what we were going for.
But you convinced a publisher to do a hardcover book on it.
Yeah, it was. We, you know, the history of the No Wave book is Byron Coley, who's a noted kind of gonzo rock journalist through the years, and an old friend of mine. We didn't know each other back then, but we met each other sort of in the early '80s, and we realized that we were like all at these the same shows. And we sort of knew the same people. The difference between Byron and I was like I was kind of. Sort of just like kind of shy and sitting in the back by myself while this activity was going on, and he was really involved with it. He was like a hard drinking guy, and he used to, you know, when Suicide was playing, I would be cowering like in the back while Alan Vega was sort of like tormenting the audience, whereas Byron would be sort of like picking fights with him, you know. So we were different people, but we sort of had, we always wanted to, we're both real hardcore archivists, through the years, I've really sort of kept quite an archive of like No Wave ephemera and stuff that I had kept from that period and stuff I've like looked for and stuff I've gotten from other people. And Byron has as well. And so when we had plans on doing a book on No Wave at some point in time, and it had been growing for years. And I went to Abrams Books to talk to an editor there about some other project, and she had mentioned that there was another editor there who's here today, Tamar Brazis, and that she was doing a book on No Wave, and this was the same editor who had did the CBGB book that Abrams did, that you must have seen. It's like a same cut size as the No Wave book, and it has the CBGB icon logo on the front, and it's like 20 years of photographs in there. Great book. And so we had heard that this editor was doing a book on No Wave, and we're like, what are you talking about? I mean, how could they? I mean, do they know what that is? You know, it's like, and we had a feeling that they thought it was more of a downtown kind of 70s nightlife, kind of like what's this? And so we kind of demanded to have a meeting, an editorial meeting. And Byron and I sat down, and I think we kind of freaked them out a little bit with what we wanted to do. It's like, this is what it is. This is what it should be. These are the people we need to get to. This is how it has to be compiled. And I think after like 30 minutes of nonstop delivery, they said, like, of course you have to do this book. So it was a little hard because I think a lot for a major publisher to put a book out on No Wave, it's pretty radical. And so I really commend Abrams for letting us do this, especially since I think a lot of their salespeople would love to sort of see a book that had more pictures of Debbie Harry, more pictures of William Burroughs, more pictures of Jean-Michel Basquiat, more sort of celebrity fodder to sort of bring people closer to it. And that did exist to some degree, but not too much. And we didn't really want to give too much play to that. So, anyway. I'm answering you, but question? Somebody else asked that question.
That was some way back.
Yeah. Do you see No Wave nowadays? Not the music, but like the ideas of No Wave, the ideals, or just something that is there and now it's gone.
I think it. Well, I. You know. As I said before, it's really interesting in retrospect the way that it's sort of referenced as a Xerox in a way, because it becomes like a Xerox of a Xerox of a Xerox. And so I think even when there's sort of, you hear sort of tendencies in certain music that might refer to things that happened on some of those initial No Wave recordings, because a lot of those initial recordings, I mean, if you listen to them, there was really no music that sounded like that at all. You know, even in punk rock, which was somewhat of a radicalized rock music at the time, if you listen to Teenage Jesus recordings, there was never, ever, ever a band like that, with a young woman fronting this band who was absolutely nobody's idea of like a female lead singer or diva. I mean, this was like a very, very angry and demonstrably strong and intelligent person at 18 years old, just making this music as a complete non-musician. But, you know, a kid who came to New York just because the New York Dolls were here, and then like seeing bands like Suicide, who were really the precursor as far as like what you could do on stage without it having to be sort of like a traditional rock and roll context. And taking that into their own hands and creating something. You know, and Lydia Lunch, the way she played guitar was basically she just strapped it on and turned the amp up and started playing slide guitar ferociously. And that was like, it was basically a way to support these lyrical ideas that she had. And
which was an important thing back then. Like, you didn't have to know how to play an instrument.
Yes, of course. Yeah, it was important. And in a way, it was like, as different as it was from punk rock, because in a way, a lot of the punk rock bands was still just rock and roll music, but just kind of sped up, somewhat damaged, somewhat, you know, a little more sort of off the cuff, whereas this was not rock and roll music at all. It had certainly the energy of it, and it was using amplifiers and electric guitars, but... you could not mistake it for a rock band. It was something else entirely. And for me, it was like, as soon as I sort of realized what was going on, even though at first it was peripheral, I became completely enamored by it. Certainly seeing somebody like Glenn Branca play at this place called A's that we had talked about, because I had heard about him to some degree, and I had seen his band, The Static, and I'd seen The Theoretical Girls, both which were just really this kind of gray zone, kind of like churning, kind of atonal music. And you know, I thought it was pretty cool, but it didn't make me want to sort of join them or anything like that. But when I saw Glenn do this thing, one of his first sort of things outside of a band where it was just him, and it was at this place called A Space, and it was like him and five other guitarists and a bass player and a drummer. And the drummer was playing sort of more sort of metronomic kind of rock moves, but the guitars were creating this, all this kind of resonant, harmonic, over-amped kind of rave-up drone music. And I had no idea, and what it sounded like to me was like what I really wanted to do, what I kept hearing in my head as far as like what you could do with electric guitars beyond sort of the typical chording that was that was historical. So I was really completely blown away by it. And then I have found out that it was achieved by the fact that he had each guitar tuned to a string. So one guitar was like a low E string, one guitar was all G's, one guitar was all this. And so he created this mass chordal kind of ensemble. And it was really, the music was really violent and really charged. So things like that were really important. And you still sort of, I mean, I still see stuff like that today to answer your question. It's great because I think there's so much has sort of happened since that time in just different respects. But I can still go see bands in different places where I live up 3 hours north, and there's bands all over the country that are completely amazing, that are very knowledgeable of that kind of approach to playing in a band. And I'm constantly amazed. In fact, I'm more amazed now that what goes on with new and young bands than any time previous. I think it's kind of like a real boon for like radical underground music.
If the city was in better financial shape back then, do you think this music would have come out of it? And could that music come out of New York City now?
No, because nobody could have afforded to live here. Nobody had any money. I mean, I didn't have any money. It's just like you just would come down and you sort of lived, you know, day to day. I mean, you could do that at the time. I think it was the last certainly the last vestiges of a generation that could do that, because New York had a history of being a haven for artists because they could live cheaply and do art and do things. And that was sort of the last era of that, because, as you know, money came in, and so it's just a different world right now.
And but it actually affected you guys, because it's interesting, doing the research for my book, I tried to go to all the places where Sonic Youth made their records all over town, and almost all those studios are gone. All the places where you recorded your first record, and Confusion of Sex, and Goo, and Daydream Nation, and your own their own studio in Murray Street, where they did all the records between.
We got evicted from Murray Street after 9/11, about two or three years after 9/11, because it's two blocks from the World Trade Center, and. We eventually did get evicted, and it's funny that you mentioned this, because somebody had just sort of sent some emails around to us about the building that we got evicted from. Mm-hmm. And it's the floor that we rehearsed on is up for sale for $2.8 million.
Wow. The floor?
Yeah.
The floor. Wow.
Yeah. And I think we were paying like maybe $1,200 a month for it at the time.
Yeah, it's a heartbreaker even to go up to, this is uptown, but the first record you ever did was at Radio City Music Hall Studios, which was this beautiful, huge studio in the Radio City Music Hall building on the ninth floor. And Blondie and the Ramones recorded some of their first records there, and Sonic Youth did their first record. Now it's now office space. It's all just cubicles.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
I didn't know.
It's kind of depressing. Anyway.
It was the old CBS studio. That's where Thelonious Monk had done some of his big band projects, and that studio had a real history.
Yeah.
But we were there all for 2 days. That's all we could afford. We did our first record there. I don't know. But.
Yeah. Anyway, any more questions?
In terms of anti-rock and roll and minimalism, how much was disco an influence on No Wave and vice versa?
How much was disco influence? Yeah. Yeah. Disco was, you know, the funny thing about disco at the time, that... You know, punk rock was so anti-disco. A lot of people forget, like, it was like death to disco, and it was such anti-disco culture. And that was such a big deal about punk rock, that is like it was decidedly anti-disco. Like the thing with the No Wave bands is they didn't really care. In fact, they thought of disco as amusing. And I remember moving here and playing with these graduates of Rhode Island School of Design. They were like the next class after David Byrne and Tina Weymouth, and they would have their art parties in Soho, and you know, I would go, and they would be playing disco records, and I remember really sort of being taken aback by that. It's like, we can't be playing these records. This is, you know, I'd be sitting there in like my Johnny Thunders t-shirt, you know, just like completely confounded by this.
Were they playing them ironically,
I think it was somewhat ironically, but they. At the same time, they were like, no, we really like this music. And then...
They weren't sure.
They weren't quite sure. But then you started hearing sort of disco moves like happening in, like, certainly like, the contortions were really into sort of, like, disco rhythmic music. And it's just like, it was more just sort of, like, taking it as... using disco as you would use some kind of cheap drug or something like that. And certainly the more progressive UK bands really employed it, like, really interestingly. You know, I mean, bands like A Public Image and Gang of Four and stuff like that, you would hear these kind of like disco moves or medium. Or
And there's Giorgio Moroder, Donna Summer records had a certain like hip cachet.
Well, I guess, I mean, they were hip. You know, the downtown also was very much a, it was a very sort of, there was kind of a wicked kind of nefarious nightclub scene that was going down here. There's really amazing, predominantly gay nightclub scenes. I mean, when I say nightclub, I mean these were like not really like super fabulous. They were kind of like, you know, they were just these funky kind of situations. And so, yeah, stuff like Giorgio Moroder, you know, it was just part of the environment. But disco was not hated. That's kind of interesting. And disco's aged well, which is kind of, nobody would have thought that in a way.
I mean, the first thing we heard of those bands is when Z Records started putting out some of the stuff, which was very much disco-oriented.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, Z Records was a French label that was coming over here and was really interested in these new bands, and they put out some of the No Wave stuff. but they knew that the only way to really sort of move units was to be put out some kind of dance kind of stuff. And they were the ones who talked James Chance into doing James White and the Blacks and doing that record off White. And which I think a lot of the contortions were just like, no, we don't want to do that. And anyway. No.
I had a question there.
Yeah, in addition to being against disco, Monty Punk was against a lot of things and was said no to a lot of things. So I was wondering if it's a no, like, is there like a negative energy that's becoming with punk and then go away and say, Sonic Youth going forward and form this assumption about your motivations, but it seems like maybe in the mid 90s, the no or the negative energy seemed to drop out a little bit from Sonic Youth. And can you speak a little bit about, you know, kind of changing motivations, either to refute and say no, or just as angry now, or you know, to say how.
We were never angry. That's sort of what we sort of wanted to. There was such a history of nihilism and negativity in the music downtown to some degree that we were sort of involved with. And I think the four of us getting together, we sort of realized that we didn't want to put on the airs of being negative or nihilistic, even though that music was really sort of informative for us. I think one thing that we wanted to do was sort of kind of deal with the negativity and nihilism as an elemental thing in the music, as opposed to something that was generally psychological for us in a way, and to be able to sort of contain it aesthetically. Without it becoming something that would sort of ultimately lead to our own sort of self-doom. And because we had sort of seen it sort of, that kind of vibe, sort of take people down in a way, or just kind of dictate their kind of personalities in unfortunate kind of ways.
Well, and that was also tied in with like the drug culture down here and all that, which you guys seem to completely skirt.
Yeah, I mean, none of us were... Yeah, we weren't like druggies or anything. That's about it.
And why not? It would have given me so much better stuff from my book.
Yeah, I mean, I was surprised. It's like this. David's book is so not the dirt. In a way, it's like, well,
I try.
Why would you want to read about this sort of? I mean, it's always been really paradoxical because you know we would do these tours with these bands that were so. Kind of, they had these legacies of being just really damaged, and I don't want to name names, but these bands would be they have a certain notoriety to them. Some of the members of the bands, etc. And basically, what they would present as a band, though, was fairly traditional musically. And then we would come out, and we were sort of like we were not really damaged. In fact, we were actually we had a certain high rate of responsibility. but we would come out, we would play this like, really kind of fucked up music. And so it was always this paradox for me. It's like, why are these like really damaged bands coming out and playing straight rock and roll, and then this really straight band comes out and plays this like this really damaged music?
Yeah, Richard Kern said to me, and his friends would say, oh, you know Sonic Youth? They're all heroin addicts, right?
Yeah,
they're the straightest people I've ever met.
We just hang out with heroin addicts. Now, when we first went on tour overseas, I mean, everybody was frightened of us. They thought we were like knife wielding drug smugglers, you know.
But you were using a drill on stage occasionally. So.
I turned 50 this year, so I think now's the time where I might start experimenting with drugs and weird sex and stuff.
Just in time for my paperback. Question way in the back there.
There's any talk of reprint because eBay is helpful sometimes, but it's hard to find some of the records.
Oh, the No Wave records?
Yeah, as far as reissues.
Yeah, I know. I mean, that's the thing. The thing is, there's lots of it's funny because there's lots of live recordings that people did at that time. The only really sort of the only really kind of portable audio equipment that people would have would be sort of the advent of. These kind of rather bulky Sony players that would put you could put a cassette player in and use a couple of mics with. And that's as small as it got. It was sort of the size of a small briefcase, and there was these Nakamichis that people would use. But nobody, there was no portable recording equipment then, really, that you could strap around your neck. The advent of the Walkman was kind of like, I think, 79, 80 is like when that started happening, and those were actually kind of heavy and big. But in 77, 78, nobody had that kind of stuff at all. But certain people like Dan Graham, the conceptual artist who lives here on Spring Street at the time, I remember he always had this kind of big thing, and he recorded a lot of those bands. And I have copies of all his tapes. And they're really fantastic to hear, because hearing these bands live, you really get a sense of what was going on with guitar playing. Because you don't, the recordings that do exist, they're somewhat tempered. They're kind of studio tempered. And even the Teenage Jesus recordings, which really come closest to like what they might have been like live, it's studio, it's produced. But the live tapes really sort of, you really can sort of hear like this really interesting kind of this kind of shared idea of like how to play guitar in different ways, and that was really a remarkable thing. I mean, at some point, you know, it's a propriety thing, because it's like a lot of these bands and musicians are sort of not sort of working anymore, and it's like, you know, it's everybody, you know, you want to sort of put this stuff out, but everybody sort of wants a little coin for it, and they're, you know, it's not like anybody can make money making records, so it's a little hard to it's a little, there's too many impossible people to deal with, like putting stuff out. And I'm surprised that a lot of it hasn't really sort of ended up on some of these sites that have bootleg recordings on the internet and stuff like that. I haven't seen any of it. I haven't heard of any of it being on there. And there's lots of the thing at that time, more so than just audio recordings, was there was a few people in the different clubs who were doing lots of early video documentation at the time. And places like Peppermint Lounge and Hurrah's and Danceteria and Irving Plaza, there is a lot of archive of all the music that was happening then. And a lot of these video makers, they have these archives, and again, it's a proprietary thing. It's like they some of them will show it at certain museum events where they, but do I've sort of the mind to try to sort of reach out to many of these people and try to parse and cherry pick all the really sort of the no wave stuff out of there, because you can see and hear it. And what would have been great was to have put a DVD in the book, so you could see and hear exactly what's going on. But it was way too problematic. But that's sort of something I actually, Byron Coley and myself, it's kind of the next move that we want to do, is actually put out an audiovisual document of the book.
I think we have time for one more question.
Awesome. Somebody asked David Brown a question.
No. This is not boring.
I'm kind of just bum rushing his trip.
Mine might be difficult for me to phrase, but I'm interested in this idea that you were talking about sort of denouncing for the sake of denouncing, or denouncing out of a recognition that you could denounce, like that the bands were doing, like denouncing for the sake of performativity or something like that. I mean, but you being aware of both the importance of the punk movement at the same time as the no wave movement and what they were both trying to do, and I know you said that the punk bands weren't really aware of the no wave bands, but when you were there in the middle of it, did you feel like that was detracting from the importance of the punk movement, since that wasn't of itself like an important
right
announcement of the
other? I don't know. I wasn't quite sure what their intention was at the time. I think the intention was really to sort of bring attention to themselves in the face of the punk rock royalty that was in New York at the time, which was just, it was a small potatoes scene. I mean, there was some media interest in it. You know, people knew about Patti Smith and Blondie and all this kind of stuff. But even in 77, it was still kind of like nobody had really bought into it outside of, like, you know, the people who were going to CBGB and Max's and stuff. And it was not, everybody knew each other. So it was a real sort of neighborhood scene. And the floodgates of acceptability had yet to sort of really happen. And, but, you know, there were certain things happening all over the world, certainly with, like, you know, like the Sex Pistols in the UK and Johnny Carson kind of commenting about it on TV when they came over and did their their U.S. tour that was a disaster at the time. And it's like, so people knew there was something going on with this subculture. They really couldn't. Because I remember listening to the radio late at night, like in 77 in WNYU, and like some guy calling in saying like, so what is this punk rock thing? Is that Nugent? Like, just really not getting it, you know?
You know? Well, the Amboy Dukes were kind of raw. Yeah.
But, the idea of a subgenre of punk rock like No Wave denouncing sort of that, I think the intention was to sort of just, there was really, why not? I mean, it wasn't like they were, you know, they didn't figure they were ever going to actually sort of make any records that sold outside of like maybe, you know, 50 copies or anything like that. So they were just having fun kind of like, you know, shooting arrows like that.
One question here, right? And then we'll wrap it up.
I mean, they were having fun. That's what I'm trying to say. It's like the idea of them being kind of all sort of dark and kind of nihilistic is kind of true. But at the same time, everybody was very... very kind of smart and funny, and they really were into like the idea of like being the surroundings that were really sort of damaged and insane, and then sort of having all these kind of great bands around them, like the Ramones and the Heartbreakers and Richard Hell and all this kind of stuff. And they, what was really something that was something that all these different people in the No Wave scene had was a real sort of interesting and cutting sense of humor about themselves and about and what was going on around them. And so that kind of belied a lot of just sort of like the, you know, the self-debasement that you might have sort of seen. So.
Well, so is it, in your opinion then, was it like this period in time before, you know, I guess before everybody felt so connected that they could make a ripple all of a sudden with their protests, or you know,
they could make
was
a ripple
like the last moment before it became easier to make a noise, I guess.
Well, things just became more expansive as far as like activity. I mean, the idea of like people doing record labels themselves, actually setting up tours themselves, a lot of that really sort of came into play soon thereafter. And it was bands sort of figuring out that they could do it themselves outside of the mainstream, even though it was like the idea of like existing in the mainstream was completely not happening. But the you know, it really happened with like the new, like the more sort of teenage punk rock bands, like the hardcore bands, who had really nothing to do with No Wave whatsoever. That was a whole other kind of like uprising, and that was people who were really into like, you know, Ramones and Sex Pistols records, but creating hardcore that was like, and you know, they couldn't really play either, and that was really fascinating seeing in of itself. But they really, it was this whole other kind of new generation of young bands that sort of went out and just like they would play every donut shop across America, and then the next band would be able to do the same thing. That's what really created this network of doing it yourself, more so than anything in the No Wave scene so much.
And then you guys like with even Black Flag, you spray painted. Did you spray paint on a dressing room wall somewhere high from Sonic Youth, or did they like you communicated through?
Yeah, people would do that. Yeah. Yeah, you would use the dressing room walls and clubs to
as your email.
Nobody had cell phones and there was no email. So we used magic markers.
All right, we'll get the last question over here.
My introduction to the genre was through the No New York album, and I'm wondering how you felt that record fit into the whole No Wave scene. And you didn't mention DNA and all, and I'm kind of curious to how you felt about them.
No New York, the No New York record was really interesting because we spend a considerable amount of time in the book dissecting that record. I mean, we talked earlier about like we don't really deal with the recording so much in the book, but we do deal with that recording because it was a very important recording in the sense that a lot of people think it really sort of created this implosion in the scene, because all of a sudden a celebrity was in the midst, and it was Brian Eno, and he came here to master a Talking Heads record, and he stayed here, and some of the people on the downtown scene who were really sort of embracing these bands, who had sort of a lot of kind of social power, people like Diego Cortez and Anya Phillips and these people, were at this social level where they could actually sort of be friends with somebody like Brian Eno. And so they took him to these No Wave concerts or gigs or whatever. Most importantly, like the one at Artist Space that was happening in 77, and to see all these bands. And Brian Eno was really enamored by the weirdo musical vibe that was going on. He's like, you know, this is something that's not going to have much of a lifespan. You know, it's in fact, it's a music that's come out of the gate fully formed. You know, it's like, where else can you go with this? I mean, and where else, what else, where do they go? It's like they actually became more kind of rock bands. So he is right. It did stop. They became something else. They became kind of normalized. And so he wanted to capture that. And there was a lot of bands that were sort of designated, certainly in retrospect, as No Wave, which we sort of do in this book. And but that record only only recorded four bands on the scene, and four bands that were kind of sort of connected, and they were all sort of friends. And it was mostly an East Village scene. It was like Teenage Jesus and the Jerks, Mars, DNA, and the Contortions. And when it came down, when everybody found out, like, okay, well, those are the bands that are going to be on this record, all the other bands on the scene, a lot of the Soho bands and some of the other bands were felt really sort of pushed to the side. And, like, you know, the whole world's just going to know No Wave by these four bands, and that's so unfair, and, you know, whatever. I think that's sort of, that was kind of the attitude, and it created this kind of animosity. And, that record, the No New York record, came out pretty much when all these bands were sort of in the process of dissipation anyway, for whatever reasons, you know. And so by the time it came out, it was kind of, that scene was kind of in transition. It was kind of over. And the record was kind of really fascinating and important at the time, even though everybody knew that, like, well, this isn't really what they sound like. I mean, I don't think Teenage Jesus and the Jerks sound really good on that record. They sound better on the Robert Quine produced 7 inches and the pink Teenage Jesus 12-inch. In fact, Lydia says Robert Quine should have recorded that album, and it would have been really, that would have been a true, genuine No Wave article. But to Brian Eno's credit, he was able to secure some studio time and some money, and did something that nobody else would do, or, you know, would have that much kind of energy to put into it. And it's become a very classic document, and one that has yet to be reissued in the USA. The only reissues that exist are a very expensive Japanese one and a kind of a weird kind of underground Russian one.
That's the ultimate irony. That record is available everywhere except America.
And I was able to get an interview with Brian Eno specifically about that record in that session, which is in the book, which was a coup because he doesn't really sort of do too much publicity or press. And I sort of got through to him and said, I don't want to talk about anything except for that period in your recording those No Wave bands. And he said, he remembered nothing, you know. In fact, I had all the details.
Welcome
why
to
he
my
was...
world.
I mean, I tell
not
you.
Not with Thurston, but Jim.
But I had empathy for him. I mean, he basically... I had to tell him why he was in New York. He's like, I don't know why I was in New York City. It was a beautiful spring day, and I decided to stay for 5 years. And I was like, well, you were here because you were mastering the Talking Heads record. He's like, no, I don't think I was. I was like, you were. I figured it out. It's like, you know, it's why you were here.
Sounds
and then you
familiar.
Went to this show, and you saw Mars at this show. You recorded them. You recorded Mars at Irving Plaza. And he's like, oh, yeah. And he's like, I was like, well, where are those recordings? He's like, I don't know. I had this machine. I was testing it out. And, but what he sort of talked about was really interesting because he did talk about it. It was very obvious to him that it was this kind of scene that was happening beneath the radar of even the punk rock scene, and that it was this kind of group of individuals doing a like-minded kind of thing, and he knew that they were not only were they going to end fairly quickly, but they were each going to sort of develop in their own way. And so DNA was one of the bands that kind of was really interesting at the time, because they sort of changed their lineup a little bit by bringing Tim Wright from Perubu into the band, who really sort of galvanized DNA into a wholly other kind of band, but they were still staunchly DNA and a no wave band. And DNA lasted well into 82, 83, when they did their final shows at CBGB. They were heralded as DNA's final shows at CBGB. And it was great, because everybody sort of came out to see DNA do their last shows at CBGB, and they were remarkable shows. I think John Zorn released recordings of those shows on his Japanese label. They were improperly recorded?
No, I said they were most recorded. Because, I mean, Tim put together an entire CD of theirs.
Yeah. That was, but by 82, by 82, 83, I think even Lee had like an early kind of Walkman prototype that he was like recording those final DNA shows. Anyway.
Well, cool. We got to wrap it up here. Thanks, everybody, for coming. We had a great time. Hope you did, too. There are books to sign, et cetera, if everybody would like some. We'll be hanging around. So.
And thank you so much. That was great. I think that was really insightful and refreshing.
Thanks.